From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. A big week ahead for Washington and the world. Today, the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem opens up with fanfare and celebrations. In Gaza, protests and scores dead. Top administration officials make the rounds to sell the Iran nuclear withdrawal. In Congress, votes are coming together for CIA nominee Gina Haspel, four competing immigration bills, and the rally around John McCain. This hour on Point, top reporters open their notebooks and look ahead to the week in Washington and around the globe. You can join us on air or online. Are you supportive of the embassy move to Jerusalem? Are you worried about an emboldened Iran? Join us at onpointradio.org. or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, commencement speaker Michael Bloomberg warns Rice University graduates of an epidemic of dishonesty in America. But first this hour, we're looking at the top stories this week. Joining me now from Washington is Susan Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker. Susan, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. Also joining me from Washington, Eliana Johnson, White House reporter from Politico. Eliana, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also in Washington, John McCormick, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. John, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you as well.
Good to be here.
So we'll start with the U.S. Embassy officially opening in Jerusalem today. Here is White House National Security Advisor John Bolton on ABC's This Week yesterday giving his argument for moving the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem.
It's a recognition of reality. If you're not prepared to recognize that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel and that's where the American embassy should be, then you're operating on a completely different wavelength. I think recognizing reality always enhances the chances for peace.
A recognition of reality. Susan Glasser, start us off here and put this moment into context for us.
Well, you know, first of all, this is something that actually American presidents and both parties have supported in theory for a long time. It hadn't been the top priority of anyone to act unilaterally to make this happen. So everyone else for years saw this as part of the bargaining in making an actual long-term peace deal that would ensue. And then basically Donald Trump has come in and sort of exploded that thinking and said, I'm just going to go ahead and do this on my own. And the question that everybody now has is, how much is this unilateral recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital going to disrupt the peace process? You see clashes today inside Israel. You see major protests occurring not only in Jerusalem, but Gaza at the border. How much will there be a new wave of violence? How much will the United States lose its traditional role as a mediator between the Arabs and the Palestinians, because the Palestinians and the Israelis, because we're seen as coming down on one side, the Israeli side?
We just got this in. Let me play this. Here is President Trump's son-in-law and White House advisor Jared Kushner speaking at the embassy dedication just a few minutes ago.
In taking this action, the United States has also chosen to strengthen the bond between our two countries. Our special bond is the envy of nations throughout the world. This bond is forged through shared history, sustained through shared interests, and immortalized through shared principles. The United States stands with Israel because we both believe in freedom.
Jared Kushner there. Eliana Johnson, I guess it's worth remembering here that two presidents, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, vowed as candidates to relocate the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, but backed away once in office amid warnings that the move could spark Arab violence or scuttle peace talks. So, okay, this decision overturns decades of U.S. policy, but here we are, President Trump. This is another example maybe of him doing just what he said he was going to do as a candidate.
That's exactly right. I don't think that you can view this president's decision in isolation. You've got to view it in the context of two previous presidents making vows that they did not follow through on. And there's nothing more that that President Trump likes than saying that he's done things that previous presidents have been unable to do. So the move of the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem is one. And you can, I think, transfer that line of thinking to negotiating with Kim Jong-un in North Korea and blowing up the Iran deal. He takes, I think, a lot of pride and satisfaction in saying that he's solving thorny problems or following through on commitments that previous presidents did not have the fortitude to do. I think that is this president's mindset going into the embassy in Jerusalem and the, all of the events today.
John McCormick, jump in here. How will this embassy opening impact tensions that already seem to be quite high in the Middle East?
You know, I think they were already very high. I don't know that necessarily how much this is going to have an impact. Obviously, on the Gaza border, it's an incredibly difficult situation for the Israeli government when you have, you know, thousands of people threatening to broach the border. How do you respond? I think people who are criticizing Israel right now need to give a specific example of what exactly they should be doing short of lethal force. It's a very ugly situation, but I don't know. On the political point here, I do think to what Aliana said, this really is one of Trump's first examples of him really succeeding in not being a typical politician. You know, in his other policy achievements, whether you think they're good or bad, you know, the Republican tax bill, that was a Republican bill. It wasn't a Trump tax bill. You know, Trump, the central premise of his campaign, he said he was going to be different, not a typical politician. This is one of the first real tangible examples of him actually doing something, achieving something that people from both parties said they were going to do, didn't do. So on a simply domestic political issue, a win for him, I think.
A lot of good calls on this point. Let me bring a listener in right at the top here, Jeffrey in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Jeffrey. You're on the air.
Yeah, I mean, I think this signals really that the idea of a two-state solution is pretty much dead. I mean, the Palestinians currently live sort of in an apartheid atmosphere, and it'll either be one state or the world will just watch them be ethnically cleansed.
Jeffrey, thank you. Susan Glasser, what about a two-state solution? Is it dead, to Jeffrey's point? And what about the peace process now?
Well, look, people have been proclaiming the two-state solution either dead or on life support for the last number of years. You have Prime Minister Netanyahu, for his part, who at one point has endorsed it but really never talks about it and clearly is not animated by the desire to go ahead in that direction. You have President Trump, who actually at various points has seemed to jettison that as the foundation of American policy, which it has been for decades, basically. President Trump, you'll remember at one point last year, basically said, one state, two state, whatever they want, I'll go ahead with it. Now, not to be so flippant, but the reason people are treating this Jerusalem decision so as such a significant move is because it is being interpreted by hardline supporters inside Israel as essentially the United States giving up on the two-state solution. There's nothing, of course, that precludes the United States from saying, well, we're going to have an embassy in Jerusalem, in West Jerusalem for the capital of the Israelis, and in East Jerusalem for the capital of a future Palestinian state. But that is not the frame in which it's being looked at today. It's certainly possible that under a future president or under a future peace deal that could happen. But I think most people see this as potentially making it more remote, not more possible.
Yes, go ahead, John.
Oh, and to Susan's point, President Obama's ambassador to Israel just tweeted out this morning, quote, "Nothing about the embassy's location prevents the emergence of a shared city with two capitals, a necessary part of a two-state solution. Inadvertently or not, Trump has opened the door for a much more frank discussion about an eventual Palestinian capital and U.S. embassy to Palestine in East Jerusalem." So again, to Susan's point, I think that this doesn't really foreclose the possibility that there will be a two-state solution. Obviously, very hard and hasn't happened for decades, but that is just perspective. Of even President Obama's ambassador.
This is just crossing the Associated Press wire. Israeli fire has killed at least 41 Palestinians during mass protests along the Gaza border. So that continues. Let's get another call in here from Oklahoma. Juergen is on the line. Welcome to the program.
Yes, I'm here.
Please, go ahead.
I'm here. Yes. A real quick comment on the deal with the embassy moving.
Mm-hmm.
That's just Trump doing exactly what he said he was going to do. The other guest, your people said that, you know, rightfully so, that two or three other presidents, you know, didn't follow through on it. And Trump is just doing exactly what he said he was going to do. And then the next thing was about John McCain. I think every bit of criticism about him is warranted. He is a war hero, yes, but it doesn't give him rights to trash the president.
Juergen, we'll get to John McCain later in the hour. We're going to finish up on the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem here. I want to play this clip because there's been a bit of controversy surrounding a pastor who is participating in the ceremonies this morning, Robert Jeffress. Here he is, an evangelical pastor giving a prayer at the opening ceremony for the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem this morning.
Now, Father, as we come to dedicate this embassy in the city of Jerusalem, the city that you named as the capital of Israel 3,000 years ago, we want to thank you for the tremendous leadership of our great president, Donald J. Trump. Without President Trump's determination, resolve, courage, we would not be here today.
Susan, Eliana, John, a lot of people wondering why this particular pastor was asked to give the prayer at the ceremonies. Mitt Romney tweeting about this saying, quote, Robert Jeffress says, quote, you can't be saved by being a Jew. Mormonism is heresy from the pit of hell. He said the same about Islam. Such a religious bigot should not be giving the prayer that opens the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, end quote. That from Mitt Romney. Susan Glasser, your thoughts on this particular angle of the story?
Well, you know, I think it was John who mentioned this is a domestic political achievement. In many ways, I would argue that this says as much about Donald Trump's political supporters here in the United States and where he's coming from as it does about his views of the Middle East. You know, this has been a top priority of a part of Trump's fervent evangelical base, some of whom have abhorrent views like the kind that you're quoting from this pastor. I don't have any insight into why he was chosen for this role, but I think Trump sees this as important to his all-crucial political base here at home.
Susan Glasser, Eliana Johnson, John McCormick, stick with us. We are discussing the week ahead in Washington and around the globe. And listeners, you can join the conversation. Now that a date is set, what are your hopes for the North Korea summit? Is it thumbs up for Gina Haspel? Do you want a public apology to John McCain? I'm Jane Clayson. Much more after this break, including your calls. Stick with us. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. If you love to find and hear great new music, but you don't know where to start, let All Songs Considered be your guide. It's NPR's weekly music discussion and discovery podcast with tons of new songs and artists to fall in love with. Hear All Songs Considered in the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking with some of Washington's top reporters this hour and looking at a big week ahead in the news. And you can join the conversation. Do you think President Trump will pull off a nuclear peace deal with North Korea? Did Gina Haspel win you over? Or did you take John McCain's warning about her to heart? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Susan Glasser this hour, staff writer at The New Yorker, Eliana Johnson, White House reporter at Politico, and John McCormick, senior writer at The Weekly Standard. Well, the Middle East is still reeling from President Trump's Iran nuclear deal withdrawal. A face-off between Israel and Iran broke out almost immediately. Israeli warplanes struck dozens of Iranian military targets inside Syria in what it says was a response to a Syrian rocket attack. Susan Glasser, does Iran no longer feel constrained at this point? Israel appears newly emboldened as well. How do you see all this?
Well, look, a lot of people were worried for months that this was the scenario that would await us when President Trump moved ahead with his campaign promise to blow up the nuclear deal that he called the worst deal ever. So on that sense, it wasn't a surprise. What's going to be a surprise is what happens next in the region. And a lot of people worry that the combination of no longer having the constraints of the Iran nuclear deal on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the sort of end stages of the Syrian civil war, that's a lot of the reason you've seen some of this jockeying for post-war position in Syria now that Bashar Assad seems to have regained the upper hand. And so I see the potential for military conflict between Israel and Iran obviously has gone way up.
Here is National Security Advisor John Bolton on CNN's State of the Union with Jake Tapper yesterday discussing the possibility of imposing sanctions on European countries after President Trump's withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal.
With all due respect, I didn't get an answer to the question. Is the U.S. going to impose sanctions on European companies that continue to do business with Iran?
I think I did give the answer.
Well, you said
answer,
we'll see.
The answer is it's possible. It depends on the conduct of other governments.
Eliana Johnson, what about that? Sanctions on European countries that do business with Iran?
I think you saw Bolton. It was notable. You saw him leave that open-ended, and I still think that's relatively unlikely. Right now, I think that's unlikely, and that the priority for the administration is dealing with North Korea first and foremost. They've got that coming up in just a few weeks. But it would truly be an extraordinary measure if you saw the President Trump sanction European countries and put pressure on them to join ranks with the U.S. And to essentially get a situation that was more similar to before the Iran deal went into place, because right now it's unclear what the economic ramifications on Iran will be with just the U.S. reimposing sanctions, but the European countries and Iran continuing as if there's still a deal in place.
Well, John McCormick, is there a consensus, I guess, is the next question on how to move forward on Iran? Is there a strategy? What do you see?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think we know exactly what the next step is right here. I agree with Eliana. I would go so far to say it would be shocking to see the United States actually impose sanctions on our European allies. You know, we have an editorial in the Weekly Standard this week saying that, you know, what happened, it shows you that the Iran deal wasn't exactly so tough. If Iran is willing to stay in it, even with the U.S. pulling out, it shows you that it's not exactly quite the tough deal it was made out to be. So I don't know. I mean, I think that Iran, I think they have been, you know, continuing to forge ahead surreptitiously. I would expect them to continue their nuclear program.
Look, the issue here really, though, is number one, President Trump has opened up an enormous rift with our European allies, not only over Iran, but that's the most significant decision he's taken to date. But remember that before the Iran nuclear deal, there were literally years not only of negotiations, but of all of the major countries in the world, including the other partners, Russia and China, agreeing to a series of escalating sanctions, pressure that eventually, along with other factors, forced Iran to the table. Nobody believes that these other countries, either our European allies or Russia and China, are willing to unilaterally operate together and reimpose those kind of tough sanctions. That leaves the United States by itself. Now, that being said, the Europeans, although they're extremely upset with how the Trump administration has proceeded, their businesses and companies obviously depend enormously on their economic relations with the United States. Faced with a choice between doing business with the U.S. and doing business with Iran, they're very likely to vote with their feet and to do business with the United States. So de facto, you could see the United States pulling Europe into a policy that it doesn't really support.
Let me get Carlos in here, a listener in Perkins, Oklahoma. Hi, Carlos. Welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks, Jane. Uh-huh. Fantastic program.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, yeah, on the deal with Iran, I think it's, you know, we pay these people $1.8 billion, you know, cash money on pallets of cash.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's ridiculous. We made ourselves look like fools.
So the Iran deal to you was a bum deal, huh, Carlos? Susan Glasser, talk about financial sanctions. There's Carlos. He hates the deal. President Trump says financial sanctions instead of the deal. Have those been implemented? How have those taken effect, if so, yet?
Well, there's a very, very complicated process, which many people are experts on. I am not. But basically, there's a very complicated process. There's a 60-day window for restarting certain sanctions. There's a longer window for reimposing others. And so you will see the United States basically begin to return to the state of hostility that it had with Iran before the nuclear agreement was signed. I think the thing that's striking to me about the success of President Trump's very clear but not necessarily always very substantive critique of the Iran deal is that it's gotten through to people like your caller. He simply labeled it the worst deal ever. What I don't see is a lot of understanding of what actually was involved in the deal. It was meant to constrain a certain area of Iranian activity. Fundamentally, the objections that you heard from John Bolton the president's new national security advisor from the president himself actually have to do with Iranian activities outside of the sphere of that deal, which dealt with Iran's nuclear program. They are rightfully concerned about Iranian military activity in the Middle East. They're concerned with the continued development of ballistic missiles, for example. And then they were worried about what would happen on the nuclear program once the deal was over. In fact, the nuclear inspectors who were part of the deal said and certified that they believed Iran was in compliance with it. Even Jim Mattis, President Trump's Secretary of Defense, said they were in compliance with the deal. The issues that have been raised tend to be largely about the things that were outside of the framework of that deal.
Let me link Iran to North Korea, John McCormick. How might withdrawing from the Iran deal shape talks, upcoming talks in this summit with North Korea?
Yeah, I mean, some critics would say this leaves the North Koreans not exactly, you know, feeling like we can, we'll live up to whatever we say. On the other hand, I think North Korea's interests here, you know, aren't they're North Korea's interests are North Korea's interests, and they're not going to be affected by this. I'm skeptical that there is going to be, you know, any real breakthrough here. I think that we've seen this before with the North Koreans. It's a lot of talk, it's happy feelings, and then they go back to advancing their program. I think there is a big concern here about how this meeting is going to go down between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. We know that the president, he says contradictory things. He likes flattery. He will will say one thing 1 minute, say the other thing the other minute. So there is a lot of concern. Another editorial we had in the Weekly Standard, not to promote the Weekly Standard too much, just calls for, we hope that Secretary Pompeo will be sitting right next to President Trump in whatever meeting takes place on June 12th.
Here is Fox News Sunday's Chris Wallace questioning Secretary of State Mike Pompeo yesterday on how the June 12th summit might affect North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un.
Are we in effect saying to Kim, if you give us what we want, you can stay on in power?
We will have to provide security assurances to be sure. This has been the trade-off that has been pending for 25 years. No president has ever put America in a position where the North Korean leadership thought that this was truly possible, that the Americans would actually do this, would lead to the place where America was no longer held at risk by the North Korean regime. That's the objective.
And here is President Trump at a campaign-style rally on Thursday in Elkhart, Indiana, touting the release of the three North Korean detainees and the upcoming summit in June with Kim Jong-un. He said his strong leadership has led to a change in North Korea's behavior.
The relationship is good, but you remember everybody in the fake news where they were saying, he's going to get us into a nuclear war. He's going to get us into a nuclear war. And you know what gets you into nuclear wars? And you know what gets you into other wars? Weakness.
North Korea is vowing, Eliana, to demolish a nuclear test site. I mean, that's something. Doesn't the president deserve some credit here? Maybe all the credit for bringing us to this point.
I actually think you're hearing bipartisan praise for the president for bringing Kim Jong-un to the table, but also a little bit of concern from experts who know the regime, many people who have negotiated with North Koreans, that once he actually gets to the meeting next month in Singapore, he will agree to a deal merely for the sake of doing a deal and then tout that deal as being something greater than it actually is. But certainly he deserves credit for doing something that no American president has ever done, which is bringing a North Korean leader to the negotiating table. And I think he's getting a lot of credit for that. That being said, I think I've started to pay attention because I'll be at that. I'll be traveling to Singapore with the president. I've started to pay attention to what North Korea experts are saying. And I think they're of two minds. On the one hand, you hear them say they believe that Kim Jong-un realizes he needs to give up his nuclear weapons. And he's prepared to do that because his country is in such dire economic condition. And on the other hand, that they think that he believes that his country's credibility is so dependent on a nuclear capability that he will never give them up. And so going in, at least for me, trying to learn more about this issue as I do so, I don't think we know.
Well, if I could just respectfully dissent, I don't think that there are a lot of people who think that Kim has any intention of giving up nuclear weapons, which he sees as the guarantor of his state. And in fact, the foundation of North Korean policy, not only under Kim, but under his father and his grandfather before then. So I don't, you know, it is certainly, I think Eliana's exactly right that both Trump and Kim have an enormous amount at stake now in this one-on-one meeting. It is an unprecedented meeting, and they both have a huge incentive to walk away proclaiming a deal, right? So the question is, what can they proclaim? And is the devil going to be in the details? Will it be, you know, years of negotiating afterwards that really tells us whether there's a deal or not? But, you know, the consensus, I think, among North Korea watchers is that nuclear weapons are, in a way, foundational to the Kim regime's view of itself and how it's managed, in fact, to get Trump to agree to a summit, because that's the other point that's really important for listeners. The North Korean leadership actually has been desperate to meet with an American president for many, many years through cycles of, you know, greater and lesser hostility. But actually, they have wanted this summit for a very long time. And American presidents, up till Donald Trump, have not even considered it. And so to many people who have watched this closely, it looks like Donald Trump is the one who made the concession in order to get the meeting. Now we'll see what happens at the meeting itself. But I think that's a very important point for people to understand.
Well, and to Susan's point, you know, just 10 years ago during the 2008 presidential campaign, or maybe it was the primary, you know, Barack Obama said, hey, I'll sit down with people like, you know, Ahmadinejad. And he was lambasted by Republicans, you know, for willing to sit down with dictators without preconditions. And now, essentially, I mean, obviously, they've made some goodwill gestures, but it doesn't seem like really any significant preconditions. And in America, the downside of this is that we are effectively granting Kim Jong-un the prestige he has so desperately craved without any tangible you know, policy achievements in exchange.
Let me get some listeners in here. Jim first in Sarasota, Florida. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, please.
I think the government thinks we got the memory of a houseplant, so they can just go ahead and say whatever they want, and we just take it for what it is. I think Trump's doing this to bolster his, or his, it's an ego-driven thing. He's bolstering his 30% popularity rating and all of that. If you go to Iran, if you forget GW, when he was president, Iran would not let the inspectors come in to inspect their facilities. I believe that they're sitting on underground facilities with their nukes. They're just doing that, what they're doing with this deal with Obama. They jumped on it because it stops sanctions and they can use the money to support Hezbollah and Hamas.
Jim, thank you. I'm going to jump in for time's sake, but I do appreciate your call because I want to get Saeed in here from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Saeed, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you, Jane. I think the withdrawal of the United States from the very faulty Iran deal sends a very clear message to the North Koreans. Remember, this is now the third or fourth cycle of such negotiations. We have bought these nuclear weapons from the North Koreans many times over. So for the North Koreans, the message of withdrawal from the Iran deal is that the United States will not stand for any less than a genuine set of concessions that we're looking for. Mm-hmm. So this time is not going to be business as usual.
Saeed, thank you. John McCormick, do you agree there? We've had a lot of false promises in the past. What about now?
That's certainly one view. You know, does North Korea see it in its interest to lose its nuclear weapons in exchange for economic prosperity? You know, I think a lot of people would say, you know, Kim Jong-un has gotten to this point by having nuclear weapons. That protects him. You know, you can go ahead and look and see what happened to, you know, Muammar Gaddafi, who gave up his nuclear program, obviously without already having nuclear weapons, without having such an advanced system. And he ended up deposed and dead.
By the way, that is, I'm so glad you brought that up, because it was actually John Bolton, who is President Trump's new national security advisor, who just a couple weeks ago in his first appearances as national security advisor said, well, we're looking at the Libya model very closely as how we want to proceed in the North Korea talks. And he meant, of course, the model of getting Gaddafi to give up his nuclear program. I'm sure the North Koreans listened to that and heard the model whereby Gaddafi ends up dead in a ditch. And so, interestingly, you did not hear Bolton repeat that when he made a new round of appearances on the Sunday shows yesterday. But I am watching very closely that emerging dynamic inside President Trump's team, because I do believe that Bolton is very skeptical of, you know, what a deal would need to be.
Hmm. We are discussing this week's biggest stories in Washington and around the globe with a terrific panel. Susan Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker, Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico, and John McCormick, senior writer at The Weekly Standard. And listeners, we'd love to have you join us when we come back. Is President Trump on the right track with his plan for prescription drug pricing? 1 year of Robert Mueller's investigation, are we any closer to the truth? Tell us your thoughts. Much more after the break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're looking ahead to a busy week in Washington. You can join the conversation with four competing immigration bills in the works. Will Congress finally move forward? What about AT&T and Michael Cohen? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Great panel today. Eliana Johnson, White House reporter at Politico, Susan Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker, and John McCormick, senior writer at The Weekly Standard. A White House aide was criticized last week for saying that Senator John McCain's opposition to CIA director nominee Gina Haspel didn't matter because he is, quote, dying. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina told Face the Nation's Margaret Brennan yesterday that if a similar situation occurred with a member of his staff, he would apologize for his office.
I just wish somebody from the White House would tell the country that was inappropriate, that's not who we are in the Trump administration, and John McCain can be criticized for any political decision he's ever made or any vote he's ever cast, but he's an American hero, and I think most Americans would like to see the Trump administration do better in situations like this. It doesn't hurt you at all to do the right thing and to be big.
And here's Meghan McCain responding to that White House aide, Kelly Sadler, and her comments about her father, Senator John McCain. This is from ABC's The View.
I don't understand what kind of environment you're working in when that would be acceptable, and then you can come to work the next day and still have a job.
Yeah.
And that's all I have to say about it.
And also,
So, Eliana Johnson, it seemed to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders seemed to be just as upset about the staffer leaking the comment as she was about the comment itself.
I think that's right. I think there is frustration in the White House that virtually everything that goes on inside leaks out. And I have to say, and I'm sure I will get pummeled for saying this, that I do think this story is perhaps getting slightly more attention than it's worth, and that this is a very low-level White House aide who said something completely inappropriate and insensitive and, you know, probably should be fired. This would have been very easy for the White House to clean up. But as we've seen, this White House has a very hard time cleaning up messes that are small and big. But, you know, it's not like Sarah Sanders or even her deputy said this. And, you know, I think everybody in every workplace says pretty bad things. And I guess the amount of airtime that's getting devoted to this at a time when there are really big issues happening, I don't totally understand it.
Let me get Rafael because he would like to speak about this. He's in Ruidosa, New Mexico. Hi, Rafael. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, I just think that this deal with McCain is totally justified. The guy is a joke. He's been a rhino all his life, and I think the sooner he's gone, the better.
All right, Rafael, thank you very much. A lot of people online here saying John McCain is a war hero, should be respected. Let me move from John McCain to Gina Haspel, because Senator McCain announced his opposition to the CIA director nominee. Over the weekend, Gina Haspel got two big boosts from two Democrats, Indiana Senator Joe Donnelly and West Virginia's Joe Manchin. Did those votes solidify the numbers that Gina Haspel needs, John McCormick, to move ahead here?
Probably. You know, you gain Manchin and Donnelly, two Democrats up for re-election in states that went heavily for Donald Trump. And if you lose Rand Paul and John McCain and possibly Jeff Flake, you're still at 50 with Mike Pence the tiebreaker. So I think you would need at least one more Republican to go rogue, to dissent, and all other Democrats then to oppose for her nomination to go down. So it looks like she's now got the votes.
And Susan Glasser, when is the Senate Intelligence Committee vote and when is the full Senate vote expected?
You know, I'm not sure. I think it's imminent, but they, like the rest of us, are probably waiting to make sure that they have the votes before moving forward. You know, I think Eliana's point is an important one, and I actually agree with her that, you know, it's fascinating to me and kind of revealing that we're still talking about this days later. And I think it has to do with your caller, you know, attacking John McCain, saying he's a Republican name only. This is a man who actually was the Republican Party's nominee for president against Barack Obama in 2008, who has dedicated his life. I think it shows what a fundamental shift and arguably implosion has occurred inside the Republican Party. It's fractured into warring component parts that really, under President Trump, aren't speaking with each other. You layer on the very atypical norms and the way in which the White House is being run, and you have this recipe for what we think of as simple controversies that can't be put to rest because our politics is speaking increasingly to groups, in my view, they don't want to put it to rest. The White House could have ended it by apologizing or firing the staffer, whatever they wanted to do. What we're seeing is intentional at this point. And so I think that's fascinating. And for those of us who are kind of every day performing what I call Trumpology, right? We're Kremlinologists of this White House. It's a revealing data point.
Yeah, I would point. I think Susan's exactly right. I would point back to now President Trump's comment during the primary that McCain isn't a war hero and that he likes people who weren't captured. So I do think that this aide is perhaps taking a cue from the boss and in thinking that it's okay to insult somebody who is perhaps terminally ill. But I do think it's pretty clear that the comment is not appropriate or even meant as a joke. I think, you know, most decent people know that. And yeah, I think Susan's exactly right that it is reflective of our larger politics and probably the sentiment in the White House. They don't like this guy.
Well, it's certainly vile, and you've actually heard some Republicans. This is not about this specific comment, but I heard just the other week Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin defending, you know, the Trump in general, saying that he's a product of our culture, which is partially true, but a pretty damning indictment of our culture, I think. But the president also affects our political culture. I mean, he is the single person that dominates, you know, our political discussion. He dominates our cultural discussion in many ways. And so I do think that you've seen this lowering of standards. What a lot of conservatives like us, the Weekly Standard, who were not so concerned about the policies, but that these issues of character and temperament would do real and lasting damage to the Republican Party, the conservative movement, and the country. And we're seeing that right now with this lowering of standards, these sorts of vile comments. And you heard your caller say that, you know, he was glad McCain's going to be gone soon, which is a pretty vile thing to say, whether, you know, no matter what you think about someone's politics.
I want to move on here. We just have a few moments left. President Trump outlined his plan on Friday to lower prescription drug prices by increasing competition and negotiating prices abroad. He called out drug makers, distributors, insurance companies, as well as government for creating a, quote, broken system. Here he is.
Government has also been part of the problem because previous leaders turned a blind eye to this incredible abuse. But under this administration, we are putting American patients first.
Eliana Johnson, investors noticed that the stocks of major drug companies rose after the president's speech. Give us the big picture here on the president's goals. Who's winning?
You know, it's interesting because the plan that the president's referring to wasn't much of a plan. It contained a lot of bullet points saying that the administration is looking into this or that, that they're doing research into certain things. The one concrete thing that you hear Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar talk about is that The administration is going to allow Medicare Part D, the federal program, to negotiate directly with drug companies. And he claims that that will reduce drug prices by up to 30%, and says that those who say that this will result in an increase in drug prices are giving them a bum rap. But that was really the only, I think, concrete takeaway from what was billed as a much more comprehensive plan to reduce drug prices.
So, John, go ahead. I hear you want to jump in, but I was just going to ask you, the president largely avoided the issues that the industry feared the most, right? Allowing Medicare to directly negotiate drug prices, allowing Americans to import drugs, those sorts of issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to look at this in the broader context of the Republican failure to really do anything substantive with Obamacare. I mean, they repealed the individual mandate. That simply increases the destabilization of marketplaces. Not quite as bad as many feared, but that's where we are. So I think what you see the president doing now is trying to do as many things, rhetorically or substantively through executive action on this. I haven't studied this closely, so I don't know exactly how much of an impact this will have on drug prices. This is one instance where the president's instincts, they're not conservative. They're not small government. So I think if he could do some sort of bigger government, anything with price controls, he would like that. But he's constrained in many ways by Congress.
Well, as we look ahead to the week ahead, we can't finish without noting that the Mueller investigation hits its one-year mark this week. Susan Glasser, I have about 30 seconds. Where does the investigation stand 1 year in?
It is in many ways very ambitious, sweeping, and what we've seen so far is essentially a little tip of the iceberg as far as the evidence amassed, as far as the details and the theory of the case that Mueller is pursuing. He's already had a number, as you know, of guilty pleas and indictments in the case. But stay tuned. This is a story that will dog President Trump for a long time.
Eliana Johnson, 10 seconds. How do you see Mueller moving forward?
I don't think it's clear, but I think the only thing I think is clear is that he is moving forward. This is not wrapping up anytime soon.
Thanks to a terrific panel today. Great insights, and we do appreciate your time. Eliana Johnson, White House reporter at Politico. Thanks, Eliana.
Thank you.
John McCormick, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. John, great to have you.
Great to be here.
And Susan Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker. Always great to have you, Susan. Thanks.
Terrific to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. In a moment, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg tells Rice University graduates that honesty matters. We'll have that. This is On Point. On Saturday, media mogul and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg delivered the commencement address at Rice University in Houston. He warned graduates about a growing epidemic of dishonesty, and he urged them to return to the values of honor and truth upon which this country was founded.
As young children, one of the first things we learned about American history is the story of George Washington and the fallen cherry tree. I cannot tell a lie, young George tells his father. I cut it down. That story is a legend, of course, but legends are passed down from generation to generation because they carry some larger truth. The cherry tree legend has endured because it's not really about George Washington. It is about us as a nation. It is about what we want for our children and what we value in our leaders, honesty. We have always lionized our two greatest presidents, Washington and Lincoln, not only for their accomplishments, but also for their honesty. We see their integrity and morals as a reflection of our honor as a nation. However, today, when we look at the city that bears Washington's name, it's hard not to wonder, what the hell happened? In 2016, the Oxford English Dictionary's word of the year was post-truth. Last year brought us the phrase alternative facts. In essence, they both mean up can be down, black can be white, truth can be false, feelings can be facts. A New York senator known for working across the aisle, my old friend Patrick Moynihan, once said, "People are entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts." That didn't used to be a controversial statement. Today, those in politics routinely dismiss any inconvenient information, no matter how factual, as fake, and they routinely say things that are demonstrably false. When authoritarian regimes around the world did this, we scoffed at them. We thought the American people would never stand for that. For my generation, the plain truth about America, the freedom, opportunity, and prosperity that we enjoyed was our most powerful advantage in the Cold War. The more the communists had access to real news, the more they would demand freedom. We believed that, and we were right. Today, though, many of those at the highest level of power see the plain truth as a threat. They fear it, they deny it, and they attack it, just as the communists once did. And so here we are in the midst of an epidemic of dishonesty and an endless barrage of lies. The trend towards elected officials propagating alternative realities, or winking at those that do, is one of the most serious dangers facing democracies. Free societies depend on citizens who recognize that deceit in government isn't something to just shrug your shoulders at. When elected officials speak as though they are above the truth, they will act as though they are above the law. And when we tolerate dishonesty, we get criminality. Sometimes it's in the form of corruption. Sometimes it's abuse of power. Sometimes it's both. If left unchecked, these abuses can erode the institutions that protect and preserve our rights and freedoms and open the door to tyranny and fascism. Now, you might say, there's always been deceitful politicians and dishonest politicians in both parties. And that's true. But there is now more tolerance for dishonesty in politics than I've seen in my lifetime. And I've been alive for one-third of the time the United States has existed. I know you find that hard to believe, so do I, but if you do the math, that's what it is. My generation can tell you, the only thing more dangerous than dishonest politicians who have no respect for the law is a chorus of enablers who defend their every lie. Remember the honor code here at Rice. Remember, the honor code here at Rice just doesn't require you to be honest. It requires you to say something if you saw others acting dishonestly. Now, that might be the most difficult part of the honor code, but it also may be the most important because violations affect the whole community. And the same is true in our country. If we want elected officials to be honest, we have to hold them accountable when they are not, or else suffer the consequences. Now, don't get me wrong. Honest people can disagree. That's what democracy is all about. But productive debate requires an exception of basic reality.
That's former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg speaking to Rice University graduates on Saturday. For a full video of his address and a transcript, go to our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poley, Catherine Proctor, Tanya Rowley, Jeremy Rolosa, and James Ross. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.